Hi, y'all. The Movie More podcast is brought to you by our listeners, patrons, and friends. If you're looking for ways to support us and our work, please go to patreon.com/JessicaOnMain. And now for this week's episode. Just wash it all, wash it. I'm getting the full Carmen treatment, huh?
There you go.
Spectacular.
Ladies and gentlemen, and all our non-binary pals, welcome to the Movie Morgue, your premier movie autopsy podcast. I'm your host, Jess Whitmore.
And I'm your co-host and producer, Annie.
And today we are going to be covering Birds of Prey, directed by Kathy Ann and written by Christina Hodson, the latest in the kind of very confusing DC cinematic, not really a universe, something. But we're going to try and grab whatever works and make that into a universe
thing. The DC cinematic grab bag, if you will.
The DC pinata.
Yes, DC pinata.
Or would it be the DC spaghetti? DC spaghetti, I feel it kind of works.
I think if it's the leftover spaghetti, that makes sense.
But yeah, no, little bit of personal context for this one. I feel like we kind of need that because this is part of like a big cultural franchise. And so let's kind of start there. Annie, how are you coming to this one?
So the cartoons are where I'm most familiar with Harley Quinn. I kind of saw those in the periphery when I was younger, so I recognize some of the costumes in this movie from that. I haven't read Birds of Prey. I'm not super up on Harley Quinn as a character, but I know a lot of people who love her. I was really glad that the trailer seemed to take this character in a different direction than what happened in Suicide Squad. I really didn't like the way that she was filmed in that, and I didn't like the way that the character was treated. So this seemed to be going in a new direction, and that was interesting to me. So, Jess, how about you?
So I have a deep and abiding love for Harley Quinn.
I can see
that. And I think that the world shares it with me. This is the dirty little secret they don't tell you, that Harley Quinn is actually their third best-selling character. It's Batman, Superman, and then Harley Quinn. That's part of why, actually, it's kind of interesting in this film, because one thing that's been kind of a cultural complaint for a couple of years is there has been a missive from on high at DC to make her costumes cosplay friendly. So that's why you've got less spandex bodysuits lately and more just like bi-colored corsets. And she's gotten very hot topic-y lately, as you may have noticed, which kind of plays into the aesthetics of this interestingly. But Harley is a very fun character, and honestly, I really don't like where she sits a lot of the time in the cultural milieu, because, like, yeah, as you can see, and this film kind of plays with that, but it's this idea that she is, you know, the Joker's henchman, the Joker's girl, the whole thing, like, you know, attached to him, and she's kind of an accessory character, but she kind of comes to her life on her own. With regards to the Birds of Prey specifically, I'm not really familiar with them as a franchise. I've not really read many of the comics, but I am kind of familiar with each of these characters on their own, in varying ways across multiple incarnations. That being said, I had good expectations out of this. I did not see Suicide Squad.
Oh.
And
good choice.
Yeah, no. I have saved myself from that evil, Annie.
Oh, you definitely
have. And
you definitely have. Mm-hmm. And bad editing.
That being said, I've apparently missed some video essays on editing because of it, but I'm okay with that. Anyways, that's kind of where I come from. So, like, I had pretty good expectations from this. The trailers showed promise in a way that I really liked. And, yeah, that's where we're going. So let's actually just go ahead and go to the review portion of this. And, Annie, tell me how you're rating this one.
I am giving this movie an A-. This is probably the most fun that I've had at a movie in recent memory. And it definitely sort of took the sting of Rise of Skywalker out of my life, as well as the sting of many other things related to how women are treated in the world. I found this movie to be really cathartic, so my response to it was, you know, very emotional. I really liked all the characters. I liked their storyline. This movie is very funny. It's also very colorful. So I think it just really kind of caught me at a moment where I was looking for something that would be funny and irreverent and about a bunch of women getting together and kicking ass. And this movie really lived up to that. How about you, Jess?
I really enjoyed my time with this. And I would also actually rate with an A-. And there are some small structural complaints. I think the pacing is a little bit kind of all over the place. But the characters are so much fun. And it is, in many ways, revolutionary, though I think it is revolutionary in a metatextual sense and not necessarily in what it does as a film or as a narrative event. I have these weird feelings about this because with this film, I really enjoyed it and I was so excited and hyped to see, you know, filmmaking by women for women, to see showcased and powerful women on screen and that kind of solidarity and those shared experiences that they're kind of drawing on.
Yeah.
But it also made me sad.
Okay.
Because I can really see where that exists in an academic sense, but I don't have, I think, a lot of the experiences that are being drawn upon here. And it's kind of isolating there because, you know, I'm trans and I have yet to really exist in public as a woman.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, I can see absolutely that, you know, the most dangerous villain is, you know, a man who is entitled to your sexuality and your body and your time and your space. I can see this kind of solidarity among women, but, like, I don't have that.
Yeah.
And, you know, I'm hopeful that I will, but at this moment in time, part of me feels like I can't quite connect to this movie, and, you know, that kind of plugs into some gender shit that's not fun for me.
I think that's really important for people to hear, though, too, because sometimes what happens with these kind of pop feminism movies is they get presented as a sort of, like, universal feminist manifesto. And that's not really what it is.
Well, you remember what happened the last time a trans critic talked about a DC movie?
Yeah. That was a really, really long month. But I think that's also why your perspective is all the more important on this one.
So, yeah, let's, fuck, I mean, I already went deep, but I want to pull back to some superficial stuff.
Yeah, sure.
Because first of all, this is actually what I was talking about here with the kind of cosplayable Harley. Her outfits are amazing!
Aren't they, though? I just want to wear, like, all of these outfits, like, let's especially that blazer.
Technical for a minute, let's just go to Cass. Yes. Margot Robbie, wonderful. And really amazing voice work, too.
So fantastic. Yeah.
Like, that is just not how she speaks. Like, she really does sound like Tara Strong. But, like, it's her own spin on it.
But very much so.
It is absolutely, especially, like, I don't think we really see that as much, where people get so much character in a narration or a voiceover.
Well, and I think, too, the idea of character work oftentimes gets mapped onto these films that are historical pieces about, you know, like, great men theory and whatever. This is a superhero movie about a group of women, and there's a ton of character work and thoughtfulness that's been put into the development of who these people are, and that's really fantastic. Yeah. I like that.
Let's just go down the list a little bit.
Yeah, Rosie Perez. This woman, I love her, packs a punch. Yeah, I like her.
Yeah, I don't actually know if she's a pre-existing character. I suspect she might be, because that's how you do these fucking movies.
Yeah.
But I'm not familiar with her character at all. I love her, and that's one thing that I saw in this very early, is the diversification of these characters, which I really like.
Yeah,
I've been having a lot of interesting thoughts about that. I've been watching the Lock and Key Netflix miniseries, which, by the way, I've realized that's what they've been doing, and they snuck that on us. All TV series are miniseries now, and no one ever updated the lingo. It's really weird. Like, that's an important structural change, and no one's talking about that.
You know, I've actually never thought of it that way.
We'll come back to that.
Yeah,
But no, she's wonderful. I love her.
Mary Elizabeth Winstead.
Okay, you know I've had a crush on her since fucking Scott Pilgrim. This is not fair. How dare you make her how dare you make her this adorable, like, badass, awkward leather lesbian. I love her so much.
Yeah, she was giving me, like, big, awkward, bisexual girl energy, and I was just so into that. It's so good. I love it.
Yeah, no, and just, like, oh my fucking God, it's so good. I love the awkwardness. And it's, like, it's a real big, like, Kristen Stewart energy, and I like that. Like, not her in her movies, but, like, her in, like, her personal life. It's, like,
yes.
Big lesbian energy. I love it.
Big time.
Oh, and also, speaking of which, rolling back for a second, did you catch that in the intro?
What?
Harley's at least bi.
Oh, yeah. No, I thought that was known. I thought that was sort of canon.
Okay, well, here's the thing. In the Harley TV show, which this, I think, shares a lot of kind of tonal resonance with,
yeah,
they have explicitly said, like, we're not going to let her be a lesbian. So, you know, that's...
Okay.
I was really excited to see that.
Okay.
You know, yeah, just no, let her and Poison Ivy be lesbians. Come on! Let them
be together. Let them be gay and do crimes.
Which, by the way, have you seen any of the new Harley show?
No, I didn't even know it was a thing. Is it good?
You should. It's really good. And tonally, it feels very similar to this film, which I really like.
Okay, I'm into it, and I'm going to have to check that out, because I would like some more of this.
Okay. So we've got Journey Smollett-Bell as that's what I get for talking about DC movies. Dinah Lance / Black Canary.
Yes. And
what a voice. Oh, what a voice.
Her scenes with Rosie Perez were so great. I don't know how they cast these two women, but they just... They have such amazing chemistry together, and that scene where she is talking about the death of her mother with Rosie Perez and just being like, no, I'm not going to help you. That scene's electric.
That scene is so good.
Yeah. So.
Oh, and like there's a little bit of framing in there as well. It's like her on the stairs versus Rosie Perez up at the top, and there's like a little bit of like, up from hell kind of dialogue going on there.
Yeah.
It's all little subtle things, and I love it so much.
I hadn't noticed that. That's great.
That being said, here's what I'm going to say to all the comics nerds real fast.
Mm-hmm.
Because, and like, here's the thing. I'm not going to associate this with comic nerddom specifically. This is just like Nazi crap. But unless she was made by a Nazi scientist to be the perfect blonde-haired, blue-eyed lounge girl, then it doesn't matter that they made her a woman of color. All right. Right. Just that's all I'm saying. That's all I'm saying there. Because she was wonderful and she killed it.
Yeah,
and I know that's going to be a dialogue. I have not seen any of that dialogue. I do not care about that dialogue. I'm just putting them on notice. And just Ewan McGregor just absolutely chewed every piece of scenery. I love him.
His performance is so rich and so naturalistic. His blocking and movement is perfect. And his line delivery just feels so real. I get the feeling that this is somebody that Ewan McGregor has seen before. He's interacted with a person like this. And so he kind of builds this character from that knowledge.
He's scary.
He's like, terrifying, honestly. Because he's rooted in the real world. And that's really
cool. That's something that I want to talk about for a minute. Because I do feel like, I alluded to this briefly, but I do feel like that is kind of the analysis of what this movie is about. Is, you know, like, this is a very feminist film in a way. Like, you know, sure, it's women being superheroes and beating people up and engaging in, I think, what are,
I mean, yeah, it's
very
feminism.
Pop feminist, but also there's kind of this deep root, because I feel like this is built out of lived experiences.
Yes, very much so.
Because the biggest danger to Roman Sionis is not when he has a gun.
Mm-hmm.
It's when he is in your personal space. The scene with the woman on the table is
horrifying. You're really right, though, that this is based in experience. Like, that was definitely one of my big takeaways as well. I'm thinking about the scene where Harley is virtually passed out. She may have had something in her drink, and she's being backed up against a wall out in front of that club in Black Canaries.
Oh, the scene in the chair?
It's the one before that.
Oh, yeah. Oh, God, that one.
Yeah. Really just kind of hit me like a ton of bricks, particularly because Black Canary does intervene, does go to her rescue, and help her, and there was that solidarity there. This strikes me as a movie that's about the counterbalance between Roman trying to exert power over everyone and Harley trying to build herself again.
And like, that's part of, I think, what really kind of hurt my movie experience with this, because like I said, I kind of grapple with a lot of these things academically.
Yeah.
And so on. But what it comes down to it is the ideas of, you know, femme solidarity and compassion and friendship and all those lived experiences.
Yeah.
Those are like aspirational and theoretical, and they're not necessarily, I think, real to me. Like, I've had so many online experiences. I know so many wonderful women who I'm just absolutely proud to call my friends and who have supported me in very real and material ways and have done so much for me. But at the same time, I have never occupied space with them, not as myself.
Yes. Yeah. And that,
and
is,
that is such a huge deal. So that is more theoretical. When something like this, the idea of the power of men, of being disregarded, of not being taken seriously, these are things that live in my mind. These are things that I'm afraid of and that are very real to me.
Yeah.
So in a way, I think there's a kind of a counterbalance of what this is built out of from, you know, the experiences of women. Is part of this is, you know, the solidarity of women and the camaraderie and the bravery and the mutuality of experience.
Yeah.
And I don't have that. So all I'm kind of left with that really hits me on a visceral level is the terror of living as a woman in this modern world.
Yeah.
And so that kind of upsets me. And it's not a knock on this film. That's just my personal baggage for this.
And again, I think that's really important because we need to be thinking about what radical inclusivity looks like if we're going to do feminist work, right? So I think you've hit the nail on the head there. For me, a lot of the experiences that these women go through in this movie resonated on a very deep level. Everything from invasions of personal space to these really asymmetrical power dynamics that are used to exploit women, keep them in their place, and become really like fundamentally abusive. I've seen a lot of conversations online about whether men should or shouldn't go and see this movie. I think that you should. I have a few men in my life who are willing to listen to me and they want to be an ally and they're thinking about this stuff. But it's a few. It's not the majority. It's not even close to half. It's a small amount. And every woman coworker that I know has stories like what we see in this movie. So even if you're just thinking about it from a popular culture perspective, I think this is actually a fairly good place to start thinking about this, to start having this conversation. Ella J. Basco as Cassandra Cain.
I love her. She is adorable. Absolutely adorable.
She just makes me so happy.
She does. And like,
but I also understand that there has been some kind of conversation about this character who I'm not familiar with, so I can't really speak to it.
So here is what's going on. Let's talk about context a little bit, because Cassandra Cain is actually a character I am actually somewhat familiar with.
Okay.
She's one of the Batgirls. I think she's still a Batgirl. Like, I don't know. Like, I think she's had like another name that's like Omen or Revenge or something really edgy like that. She's the gimpy Batgirl. She's the one with all the stitches and stuff. It's basically if you took, you know, Michelle Pfeiffer's Catwoman and made her into Batgirl, that's kind of her character design. But historically, she has this backstory where she was the child of an assassin who did not teach her to speak, but instead taught her to read body language in the same way by using the kind of like vocal processing center. So she's like this perfect undefeatable fighter who cannot talk until there's such things as like, I think there's been various versions of it. Like basically like many of the magical characters or so on have been like, oh, you know, we're going to grant you the speech. And then she's got this whole like, you know, kung fu quest for self-discovery to like regain her ability to perfectly read movements and so on. It's a whole thing. But that being said, this is not, who wrote that thread again?
Gail Simone, who I think was one of the writers of Birds of Prey.
Yes, she wrote a run on Birds of Prey, and she had a really great thread on this. But what she essentially came down to, and her eventual conclusion, was that this is not Cassandra Cain. And I kind of agree with that assessment. But also, two things. One, I was so excited that Cassandra Cain was a chubby Asian girl, because yeah. Cassandra Cain is a DC Comics girl. So she is the most, like, skinny, taut, impossibly sexy, like, figures, and it's not cool, honestly. Like, she's the kind of girl I want to be that I'm going to kill myself trying to become. And that's bad. So, like, just seeing, like, a chubby Asian girl in that role is great. But second of all, like, yeah, she's not the same character, but also Cassandra Cain does not work in a film. She is a serial character, because it's all about, like, the long journey to revenge and these kind of gradual things. And especially early in her thing, where it's, like, learning to speak and, like, being a mostly silent character, that doesn't work unless you have, like, you know, 13 hours to kind of interspeed footage and, like, take her on that journey. She does not work as a cinematic character. And the character they've done here, I think, is a wonderful start. And it's going to be a very different character, but I like it. This is the only time where I'm going to see, like, yeah, it's not really comic accurate in a way that actually means something.
Okay.
That's kind of my comment on that. That's but cool. Yeah, no, it's...
I was kind of excited that also, she wasn't yet another exoticized young Asian woman character, because I think we've seen a lot of that in cinema in the past 5 to 10 years. Like, obviously, there's this really long history of that, but of late, it's cropped up again as one of these really key tropes in superhero movies. So it was just kind of cool to see her not embody that, to see her be quirky and weird, to see her be, you know, this curvy young woman who's kind of thrown into these crazy circumstances. I like that. It was interesting. The character was nuanced.
And also, like, well, first of all, can you believe ScarJo played all those roles?
How dare you?
No. But secondly, one thing I actually really like about her is she is a character who's set up in kind of a damsel role, but yeah. She's never a damsel.
Yeah.
She is, and this is actually probably my favorite thing about her, and I think something that I'm kind of thinking about now and kind of academicizing? I'm putting into smart words why theorizing. I like her so much. No, academicizing. That's the word. I'm making words. I'm revolutionizing the English language. Don't stop me.
Revolutionizing. Okay.
There we go. Perfect. Beautiful. Fine. No. But what I like about her is she is not respectable.
Yeah.
In any way.
Yeah. Love that.
She is rude, she is belligerent, and she is not taking any shit.
And she's a pickpocket.
Yeah. No, it's wonderful. Yeah. But I feel like in these roles, there's a lot to be said about respectability politics.
Oh,
and
yeah.
it plays in many different subtle ways. But one thing I'm seeing in this is that we're kind of dodging that bullet in that, first of all, basically everyone in this movie is irreverent. I cannot talk today. I just cannot talk today.
It's fine.
Everyone in this movie is irreverent.
Yeah.
But Cassandra Cain in particular, she is kind of a token to be traded around a little bit. Like, I will admit that, like, on like some kind of technical writing level, she does not have as much agency as we should like.
No,
but
she doesn't.
At the same time, within that role, while being traded and betrayed and sought after by multiple factions and so on, she never becomes an object. She is always, at the very least, objecting to and defying that kind of authority that is placed upon her.
Yes.
And that's something that I don't really think we've ever seen from, like, a lot of people have tried to subvert damsel roles or to play them in interesting ways. And I think fundamentally the thing that I never really see is just like, hey, don't fucking do this to me, asshole. That's not cool.
Yeah, I mean,
fuck you.
It's defiance, right? Which is not something that we may be used to seeing in movies when it comes to the way that women are treated. And I think that's another thing that I really like about this movie that you've just kind of hit on, talking about respectability as well. These are ungovernable women. They not only refuse a lot of the sort of politics of these institutional structures like the police, but they're also refusing respectability, which is this kind of middle class politics of citizenship, right? They're just kind of saying F to that, And I really respect that defiance. It's part of what makes them ungovernable.
Yeah. Okay, so I think that's kind of our coverage of the cast. There's a couple of bit roles that are kind of fun.
Yeah.
Ali Wong, I love her.
Oh, yes, I love her. So, she was awesome.
No, there's a couple more, but, like, it's wonderful. It mm-hmm. it really is, and
I think people I'm should go and see it. I'm kind of sad that I haven't
really pulled.
I don't know.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. It's a visual feast.
Yeah, I mean, it really is worth going to see in theaters. I have seen a couple conversations going on online, some articles about how the authors feel that the R rating placed on the movie is going to prevent people from going and seeing it, and how it really could have had just a PG-13 rating, and that would have led to more people going to theaters.
I do not think this is a PG-13 movie. Here's
language and a couple stunts.
No. Okay. The language, sure.
You okay?
Honestly, though, kids fucking talk like that. But
yeah.
Here's the thing, and I want to talk about the rating of this because, like, this is something that I think is kind of fucked up about us, because okay. I am completely desensitized to this violence. Because this is something I've realized has happened a lot over the years. Mm-hmm. I think particularly in our conversation about, like, Terminator 2, for example, it's like, I should not have been watching all this shit since I was a little kid. Because, like, that's actually kind of fucked up. Yeah. One thing that this movie seems to have a penchant for is just breaking knees in, like, a very visceral way.
Oh, yeah.
Yep. And so, like, yes, there a lot of the violence is kind of, you know, acrobatic.
Yeah, it was,
and,
like, easy to forget about the knee.
Exactly, right? But a lot of the violence is, like, acrobatic and full of panache and, like, fun and whimsical. But also, there is a lot of very visceral violence. Even if there's not that much blood,
mm-hmm.
this yeah, is the kind point. Of violence that kids do not like. Because I teach children. I teach children right. animation. Yeah. And one thing that I know is children love violence. They hate consequential violence. And that is to say that I have shown kids, like, you know, men with machine guns mowing down crowds, and they don't even blink. But I show the single, like, gut stab from Sword of the Stranger, and that, like, tiny trickle of blood makes them, like, wince and cry and back away from the screen. Is we do not like, as societally, like, we've been taught that violence is cheap, that violence doesn't mean anything, that it is just the kind of neutral background noise to conflict and society and to, like, our ways of storytelling.
Yeah, it's a form of language.
Yeah. And so, in a way, I think this does really earn the R rating, even without that much blood, because there is so much violence that hurts. And I don't think that's something we really kind of recognize. The other thing that I also think is going to earn this the R rating, and, like, is, like, there's a lot of, like, subtext of date rape. There's yeah. a lot of that.
Yeah, I mean, this movie is dealing with some really serious stuff. One of the things that I wanted to find out from you, though, is do you think that this article is right? Is the R rating going to, quote-unquote, hold people back from going to see this?
I mean, I think what that comes down to is perception as reality. Because this is something that we see a lot with animated films, is this idea that, or, you know, animation in general, this idea that animation is for children. Because people believe it, they make it true.
That's true.
Because yeah. people don't go out to see, I mean, people do, but, like, you know, broadly, societally, statistically speaking, people don't go out to see adult animation, so all adult animation is porn or weird, like, hypersexualized juvenile bullshit.
I see what you're saying.
Blah, blah,
yeah.
blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
I've got a lot of personal hang-ups about that, well, animator yeah. and all that. So, yeah, and so it's this idea that comic book movies are for children.
Mm.
And so there's this conflict between what an R-rated movie is supposed to be and what children are supposed to see, because this is a comic book movie. And that's not a real problem. When you look at the success of things like Deadpool, is like, R-rated movies can sell, R-rated comic book movies can sell, but it's all, you know, NYT op-ed people or studio executives who say, like, can we really sell an R-rated movie? People won't see that. People are going to fucking see it if they want to see it. The thing is, the people who are saying this have influence to make it true or not.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's dead on. That's also something that I was thinking too. They kind of have this power in the situation to determine whether people go and see it. A lot of the people that I know who are saying, yes, you should go and see it, are women film critics. And they're not in a lot of the mainstream publications, so... But let's talk about visuals in this movie.
I think that's one of the reasons I want to see something in theaters. First of all, like, going with friends and, like, sharing the experience like that, making an event of it. But secondly, when a movie is a visual treat, it is worth seeing on a big screen. I think there are some films that it does not matter what screen you see them on, or it matters less. But for this, this was a visual feast. This was such a colorful film. And, like, in particular, I think, like, let's say hypothetically, thought experiment, that you had a theater rented out for 5 minutes and you could only watch one scene from this movie. What scene would you pitch? I just want to hear that before I throw mine out there.
That's too hard. There's like three scenes that I can pick out off the top of my head. Okay, so the first scene that I would pick would definitely be one of the final fights in the amusement park. The second one would be the jail fight. And
that's the one. Oh,
wait. Is that the one that you were going to pick?
The jail fight. Okay. No, that's not the one I was going to pick. Sorry. You're describing something different.
Because now that I've listed two,
the assault on the police precinct.
Oh, yes.
Which leads to the jail fight. But I'm just like, wait, no, jail is the cell. Okay, that's not what I'm thinking of. It's where Harley's going in with an M79 grenade launcher and a bunch of like smoke bombs and glitter bombs. Oh my God, it's so good. And honestly,
magical.
And here's how you know, like, I had some fucked up shit going on, because like, I've wanted an M79 grenade launcher since I was like 9. there is something so cool about breech loading a gun. That's why, like, you know, the double barreled shotgun is still so much fun after all these years.
Yeah.
That's why, like, fucking like skeet shooting guns are in, like, fucking Call of Duty. Because reloading out the back of your gun is fun as hell. And doing that with a grenade launcher is so much fun. But she's got that bandolier. She's doing all these athletic, acrobatic... Blah, 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 cannot talk today. She's doing all these spins and stuff. And by the way, one thing I really want to say, I think we haven't really talked about this, is we need to give so many props to the stuntmen in this movie.
All the props, all the time. Because the stunts in this movie are... freaking perfect. So beautifully choreographed and so perfectly and flawlessly executed.
There's wonderful. And like, they're throwing everything into this. And I think, like, I can't even point to any specific stunts, but one thing I can note kind of consistently in this film is there are so many scenes where a stuntman has just thrown himself into the air in a spin. And, like, there's a real kineticism to that, and it feels very genuine. I love... am I the one who feels like a little bit of Jackie Chan in this?
Maybe.
Like, just a tiny bit?
Maybe a tiny bit. I mean, Chan's style of fighting is really about physical comedy. And I think in this movie, more of what I saw was a bricolage of different fighting techniques, particularly that are built around how women fight and how women fight opponents who are larger or taller or have a longer reach than they do. So a lot more of the aerial attacks that we see on the WWE and stuff from wrestling and judo, stuff like that.
Yeah. Actually, that's one thing I really liked is there was a lot less striking in this movie. There's a lot more judo and body weight play, which I think was really fantastic. I'm actually reminded somewhat of John Wick, though not in the same kind of aesthetic style of how they present the violence. But this idea of when I first watched John Wick 1, my thought for how to describe that action, the way that they framed a lot of their inter-body physical conflict, was two weights on a string spinning in space, is that you had people and bodies grabbing onto each other and then rotating around each other to exert force and influence. And there was definitely a lot of that. Sure, there's some silly stuff like, you know, catching the back of someone's neck with the, you know, arch of your foot and then, like, knocking them into the ground. But, like, there's a lot of actually, like, legit kind of, like, judo moves in there where, like, you know, you're swinging yourself around someone to exert leverage on a limb that can't take that.
Mm-hmm.
So it's wonderful.
It is wonderful. And I think what's really cool about that to me, so like as somebody who has done, you know, like boxing and fencing before, you know, I wasn't like a major competitor or anything like that. It was something that I did because I enjoyed it immensely and I liked the training of it. One of the things that this movie really gets right is how you fight with an opponent who is taller than you or has more body weight than you or muscle mass than you. And that's partly why we're seeing those aerial moves, why we're seeing so many moves that you identify as judo, where you're using somebody's body weight against them, as well as moves that are about getting outside of somebody's reach and then inside, inside that reach as quickly as they can to disable them. So that's very much in the style that women are taught to use when you do defense and combat training stuff.
What were you going to talk about before I pulled us back to stuntmen and fighting and choreography?
I was just saying that we should talk about some of the different scenes from this film. Like, you brought up the jail. I think that the jail break-in is a fantastic moment in the movie. I love the breakfast sandwich bit.
Oh, God, I want that sandwich.
That spoke to me at a deep, deep level.
It looks so good.
And, you know, like, as somebody who doesn't make a huge amount of money, who just freaking loves breakfast, that bit was so small, and it was just such a wonderful gesture to me. To me as a moviegoer, and it just immediately brought me in and made me feel like, oh, there are all these different things that I clearly share with this character. So kudos to them on making me relate to Harley Quinn through a breakfast sandwich.
Yeah, no, she's wonderful, first of all, but also another thing is I kind of love that scene because she is very clearly still drunk or hungover.
Oh, yeah.
And, like, I relate to that so much. Is it's being at a food truck at 2 in the morning.
Yes. That's the best time and to get that salty, cheesy egg when you're hungover.
I want that. And honestly, I was genuinely heartbroken when she didn't get to have right. it. And I was genuinely happy when she got to have one at the end.
Yes.
Such and also, like, what I actually kind of like, and I think maybe this isn't necessarily the best thing to exist that they've done, but it is funny because, like, you know, the studios kind of want them to do it anyways, and so they're doing it. But, like, they're using the fucking Marilyn Monroe orgasm faces and noises around that scene. It is very much a sexually charged scene. And I like that they've taken that away from, like, you know, male sexuality and exploitation to just be like, this girl wants a fucking sandwich, and
Yeah, now that you brought that up, I thought that was such an interesting moment in the film where Harley is being beaten up by Roman and she dissociates, and that Marilyn Monroe song about diamonds are a girl's best friend, like, that is part of her dissociative fantasy. There's so much in that that's worth talking about. I would love to talk about some of Marilyn Monroe's movies at some point, too, because I have a lot to say about that.
Oh, no, it's wonderful. And I think it's wonderful. And I was honestly, I'm kind of disappointed that they never came back to stuff like that. Because if you had at least one more song, you could technically call this a musical. But they
That's
don't.
Right.
And it makes me a little bit sad. It makes me a little bit sad. That being said, I love that sequence. I love the costumes. I love the pageantry. And Margot Robbie is wonderful, and I really respect her work. And she's beautiful, and I kind of hate her for it. But, you know, that's how I feel about everyone. That being said, I will say Harley Quinn is kind of a problematic character.
Yeah.
In that she is an offshoot of the Joker, and it's kind of defined by insanity.
Yes.
And yeah. I think they managed to kind of walk a tightrope with this one, where, like, that's clearly some kind of, you know, like, dissociative episode, and she's shown to be whimsical, but I don't feel like she's necessarily painted as being any kind of particular pathology or even really insane to begin with. She's just kind of adapting and living, and I think, like, the character and the history is stigmatized and associated with a lot of bad stuff, but I don't think any of that is necessarily reflected on in a bad way in this film.
I mean, I think anytime we start with a character who is presented in the comics variously as the crazy girlfriend, is pathologized as the insane woman. That is a problem. What I like about this movie, though, is that it undermines that stereotype. There's more of a focus here on Harley Quinn liberating herself, creating herself kind of anew in the wake of getting out of this abusive relationship with the Joker. And I think there's a lot of different stuff that you can take away from this. So, you know, on the one hand, the mental and emotional tax of leaving an abusive relationship, particularly one where you've defined yourself and have been defined by others through your relationship to your abuser. That is so hard. That's so difficult. It's so difficult to build yourself up after that. So there's that, and then I think there's also this exploration of the self, of who do I want to be, what do I want to look like, how do I want to sound, what do I want to dress like, all of that stuff, which you get to kind of create yourself in a way. And her sequins, her Harlequin aesthetic is defiant. And that's also what I like about that Harlequin speech.
Yeah, that was a really good speech, actually. I like that.
It's so good. A Harlequin serves a master. And this is about her rebellion against that power structure.
And this is I think, like kind that. Of, I think, the aesthetic balance that this film strikes really well is it's very, you know, pop feminism, very pop culture. But there is, I think, a depth to the experience that is being drawn upon that you have to keep an eye out for. Mm-hmm. And in that, I feel like that it's never lacking in that department.
It's not. And I think this really kind of speaks to why it's important to have particularly women of color at the helm of creative projects at all levels, not just the director, who is incredible. Thank you so much for this film, because it was fun for me. It made me feel joy. But also at other creative levels, they brought in Black hairstylists to work on Black Canary's hair. This doesn't sound revolutionary, but in Hollywood, trust me, that is a big issue. So this is an important moment.
And I think this is actually, like, it's a huge bonus, and I think a real case study in the importance of and why it's actually, like, a real benefit to have diversity in creative mediums like this is because, straight up, like, I don't think a man could write this movie.
So I thought a lot about this, actually, because on the one hand, I do kind of agree with you. In this particular moment, in this particular climate, and with the structures in place as they are currently, no. Like, just no. The structures that you would need to have in place to create a radical culture of inclusivity and thoughtfulness, a woman-centered, and I would argue a woman of color-centered storytelling practice that includes not only writing, but cinematography and editing and sound, it's not there. It's not in place. And so, you know, there are all of these women directors who are creating a space for that, right? Who are trying to do that work. Yeah, so Kathy Yan, who directed this movie, is part of a generation of women directors who are trying to create that space, and I think who are really paving a path forward for other women. And this includes other directors like Ava DuVernay, who has really been instrumental to breaking the path forward for women in Hollywood, as well as Greta Gerwig and Kathryn Bigelow. So it's happening. But it's happening slowly because the structures aren't in place to incentivize it.
That really is, I think, a triumph for this movie. And I think it's honestly like a bigger trend that we're seeing all across the thing. We're seeing more creations by people of color. Yeah. We're seeing more creations by women. We're seeing more creations by queer and gender nonconforming folks. Like that last one, it's going to take a while to catch up. But like the very fact that this is rare is a problem.
Yeah.
But we're getting there, and that's such a good thing to see.
If we want to talk about... Oh, I kind of wanted to talk about Roman and art.
Okay, I feel like this is going to be your bag here, because there's a lot of kind of colonial museum shit going on here. So if you want to, you want to just go ham?
Yeah, I mean, sure. Why not? I'm really excited to see this come up again in a contemporary blockbuster after Black Panther already had, you know, this really substantial conversation about museums and museum curations and the idea that museums are not neutral. That's great. What's cool about this movie is that it's talking about the history of white people, colonialism, and collecting, because private collections are also part of colonialism. And, you know, it's not just talking about collecting, it's also talking about the art market and the extent to which racism pervades the structure, and in which you have all these wealthy white male collectors who are just going and collecting objects that they find exotic, objects that they can map their personal worldviews onto. In this case, the shrunken heads, which Roman talks about as, you know, kind of a way to hold on to power. We also see Roman's, I guess, his sort of gang that he assembles in the end, they are wearing masks. And the masks have this distinctive Africanizing style to them, which he also shows us African masks in his collection. This is somebody who is extending the logics of a colonial system of domination and imperialism into physical space. And it's also showing the connection between the sort of imperialist logic and heterosexist patriarchy. Perhaps the most important aspect of that is how the self is defined in white heterosexist patriarchy. This image of a white man defining himself through what he is not, through these stilted, stereotypical images of other cultures that he considers to be non-Western, and I put that in heavy quotes, and thus inferior. Yeah, that's authoritarian masculinity, yeah, right there.
I find it kind of fascinating how he is kind of, in a way, a one-man colony, a one-man empire, a one-man museum.
He's great man theory in a single body.
Essentially, because when you look at kind of where he's fictionally positioned, is he is... Granted, it's Gotham, but, you know, he's a crime boss. But at the same time, he is bringing this grandiosity and this prestige upon himself. It's like he hangs out above a fucking alleyway watching it and watching his fucking employees. He's an unstable maniac.
Yeah.
At the same time, though, he's like, I have this, you know, sculpture by prestige. I have all these things. I have these, the 1500 years old, and I'm British now for some reason. And you have his lounge, and it's all about ownership, and it's about taking these things that have a history and a prestige and a beauty and owning it.
Yeah, it's about domination.
You can very much you can very much see that with how he initially treats Black Canary. Is she is his songbird, she is a decoration, she is an extension of himself.
She's an object that he puts in a cabinet of curiosities, like what he's got in his apartment, which is just... That is some classic art history there for you.
And it is this externalization of the self. It is filling a void with objects and with paraphernalia.
Yes.
It's just so much that the choice of this paraphernalia is focused on prestige and... In a way, I think it's kind of interesting because when you look at how it's assembled with all this prestige and so on, it does feel fundamentally insecure.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. Because I don't feel like he actually loves anything.
No, that's because he doesn't. The objects in his collection are there for him to create himself through. They're there for him to map these different kind of meanings onto when he talks to people about the objects. And what he's really talking about is who he is as a person. Which, Jess, I think kind of goes back to some of the conversations we've had about the contemporary culture of the performance of mastery, because that's really what this is. He doesn't know anything about these objects. He doesn't know anything about the cultures they're from. He's purely performing a mastery over them to talk about himself.
So one thing I actually want to comment on, and this is kind of a fun comment, I think, because you talk about mastery, and I've talked about kind of media mastery and so on in the past, but I think if Roman Sionis were a smaller man, you know, if his empire wasn't, you know, this lounge in Gotham City, if it was, say, like a small apartment in New Jersey, it would be full of Funko Pops. Because one of the things I see is he does not want Black Canary to recognize or to appreciate any of the objects he is pointing her to. He wants to name them and demonstrate their value.
Well, yeah.
So it's not a question of I like this. It's a question of this is a thing that gives me some kind of social capital or value or mastery for having.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely.
Because this is how I feel about Funko Pops. They're ugly. Like, 99% of them are stinking fucking garbage. And it's just a question of, like, that's from Game of Thrones. I like Game of Thrones. You, presumably, statistically speaking, also like Game of Thrones. So this creates a mutual bond for us, and you can respect that I have Game of Thrones around me. It's like, fuck you. It's a signifier. There is no substance in that.
This is making me feel guilty.
Can you tell that I hate...
I can tell that you hate them. I can tell. And as you were going on that, I was looking back at my Funko Pops from Thor Ragnarok. But yeah, no, I do get what you're saying. Like, they're ugly. I think they're kind of, like, ugly cute, and I like to get characters that I like. But I also get it. People collect them, and for dumb reasons.
Yeah. And, like, I don't think it's necessarily wrong for any individual to like something for any kind of reason.
Way to backtrack.
Like, I want to be clear that I'm not just like, oh, you've got a Funko Pop, you're a bad person, you're some kind of plebeian. That's not
what
I'm saying. What I'm saying is kind of the cultural institution that creates Funko Pops is that is the psychology that they are relying on as a corporation to sell these.
Yes, definitely.
Because, first of all, one of their big selling points is like, oh, you know, there's nothing else of this character. Here's a character from a thing, and we've made a cheap vinyl figure of it, so, you know, you can buy it and, you know, show support to your favorite show or, you know, show people that you're a fan. And I think there is not much artistry to the Funko Pop, especially because they take everything, the most unique and beautiful things, and homogenize them into these samey fucking little tiny figures. And so it becomes about the signifier. It becomes about recognizing them. And that's what they are, is they are almost pure symbols. And, you know, we're going back to fucking symbols and simulacra here, but That's what they are. And that is how Roman Sionis treats everything in his own personal museum, is this is a shrunken head. These are the things that I own. This is the breadth of my domain.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
I also just want to give props to Ewan McGregor again for being willing to play this role. I think I can't imagine how interesting it must be to kind of play a role like that, because I can see so many men looking at a role like this in the presentation and either not understanding the fundamental terror of what they're trying to do or being offended and fragile about, like, well, not all men.
Yeah.
And so I do think, first of all, just from the emphatic nature of the performance, is that I do think there was some level of understanding, at the very least, for him to nail that so well. But also, I do feel like, in many ways, it might be considered a creative risk. And that I appreciate that he was willing to participate in this project, because he was perfect in it.
Yeah, I mean, I really have to co-sign on that. Like, he was the right choice in terms of casting. And it's very clear throughout the movie that he understands the point the film is driving at. And that's just really cool to see as well. Even though he is playing this just absolute dirtbag of a character, I think it speaks to Kathy Yan's abilities and strengths as a director that this movie is so well put together, that the actors are so dialed in, and that the character work is this strong. Like, not to give all the credit to the director, but I think that she has really worked with everyone on this set to make sure that this group enacts this vision of Harley Quinn.
It's also kind of interesting how his character functions. Because Black Mask is an interesting character. He's a little bit of a B-lister in Batman's Rogues Gallery. But I feel like specifically in this film, I think there is a very specific context that he comes into. And he is a substitute Joker.
He's a rich boy with designs on power. Yeah.
And in a way, and like to make a direct comparison, to go back to kind of this idea of risk-taking and acting and the kind of like load this would take and the capacity that you need for this. Honestly, I'm throwing some fucking shade here, but Jared Leto could not do this.
No, he could not.
And like to look at kind of where he's coming from in this, I think the thing that this most required was trust, because I don't think like a man necessarily understands this role except for like maybe some circumstances that are really not great to have in your life. And I think you kind of have to defer to the, you know, creative heads of this project and say, tell me what you need. Tell me what you want. Maybe I don't entirely get it, but I'm willing to work with this. And that really worked well. Is he is a substitute Joker? Is he is another powerful man. He is an unstable man who is belligerent and throwing a tantrum when he does not get that to which he is entitled. And I've really not seen many roles like this of entitled men. And like, I think we've seen shades of this that comes out naturally, but it's always portrayed, I think, like when I see entitled men, it's always portrayed in this way that is kind of infantilizing.
Yeah.
Where, you know, you have like the gangsters like, oh no, he's falling apart and this is what he's doing because he was a weak man.
Yeah.
And that's not the case here. It's because he is a man.
Yeah.
It is because of the kind of social position that he is in.
Mm-hmm. I do want to give Ewan McGregor a tiny bit of credit, though, too, because I think there's a lot of actors in Hollywood who have talked about some of the things that they have noticed that men and men producers will do from having conversations with their women co-stars. So I think, you know, when you have some exposure to that, again, experiential component of women's women's lived experiences, I think you're going to kind of have a vision for how to do this that will obviously be guided by a director, but you may have some idea of what you want to do with the role just from that. There's been a lot of conversations about the behavior of producers and directors on set, all that kind of stuff. So I don't doubt that he has seen some of this toxic behavior before and kind of found an inroads into channeling that into this piece.
Absolutely. Like, I don't mean to take away any credit from him, because, again, we are, like, praising him at this exact second in time.
Yeah, no, I
totally I'm just kind of exploring a lot of weird thoughts, I guess.
Yeah, which is legit.
Yeah. Also, I just want to say, real fast, going back to cast, because I missed this one, I really like Victor Zsasz in this, played by... Chris Messina.
Yeah.
He's lovely. And this is actually one thing I really liked about this, because that's a character I recognize. He's not the biggest member. Like, he's a serial killer. He's not, like, you know, the Joker or Mr. Freeze or the Penguin. He's not, like, a mass murdering, big flashy one. But he's from some of the more obscure or smaller scale Batman stories. And I recognize him primarily from Batman Arkham Asylum.
Okay.
And so, for me, I really like this because he fits naturally into this story. And I didn't realize who he was until his name was said, and then everything kind of clicked into place. You know, the face cutting, the scars, and so on.
Yeah.
And, like, it's very naturalistic, whereas I feel like a lot of times when you want to put a character into these, there is a lot of, I think, maybe studio pressure, and I think kind of creative unconfidence?
A lack of confidence about it, yeah.
There's a lack of confidence that leads you to need to signpost everything in extreme clarity. Mm. Is like, you know, like how so they didn't introduce Huntress by name for a long time. And it's like, I feel like in many films like this, where it's very toyetic and it's relying on these big franchises, is you need to be really unsubtle about this. And so I like that. I like how that kind of fit in there, and the pieces kind of click together in the later half of the movie, because I feel like he could have been like any kind of knife wielding maniac, and that would be fine. It would be serviceable. But they found a way to like kind of move this character in a way that felt natural and gave it just a tiny bit more weight. I don't imagine there's like, you know, ZazzCon and a whole bunch of Zazz cosplayers who are going to be really mad that he wasn't portrayed as like bald like he is in this one incarnation, that his scars weren't done right.
I'm but, trying like, to figure out what ZazzCon something. Would even be. Like, ZazzCon does not sound like cosplay for this character. It sounds like a vacuum cleaner conference. Sorry, Victor Zsasz cosplayers. My bad.
Yeah, I think what it comes down to is this is a women's movie. Yeah. And that is such a wonderful thing. You can see it all over the place. Like, there's just, like, I love that there was, when Harley was doing the whole, like, here's the person who hates me, here's their grievance.
Oh, that and was, one was amazing. Just
the no eggplant is like, yes. Yeah, here's a man who wants to kill me because I wouldn't fuck him.
Yeah.
That's the real thing.
Yeah,
and, that was amazing. Like, I don't think we've necessarily had the kind of sway and power and institutional inertia to say, like, we are women and these are the experiences that we're going to reflect and we're going to put them out into culture. These have always been things that are in books or, you know, in blog posts, but, and like, you know, maybe obscure artsy indie movies, but this is something that I think is only beginning now to come to Hollywood, and that's really wonderful. And that's kind of my final conclusion on this, is that's what this is, and that for whatever flaws it might have, that does make this a very significant and important film. And again, I'm happy to see it, and I'm a little sad that I don't think I connect to it in quite the same way that a lot of women will.
Sure. I guess my final thought on the movie is that I hope people go and see it. I know that I'm harping on that a lot, but this is going to be one of those movies that sticks with me for a while. There was just a lot of stuff that I related to. There were also so many sequences that I really liked, so many costumes that I just absolutely loved, like Harley's blazer at the end. I love the roller skate the transparent car chase. That
I love the clear jacket with the police tape confetti sleeves.
Yes.
There's so many good looks, and it's so fucking colorful.
Yeah.
Without being like, just like, oh, and this scene is red.
Ooh, and it was just such a great, like, redemption arc from the way that her character is treated and filmed in Suicide Squad, which was something that had always, like, that deeply irked me when I first saw Suicide Squad. What a change we see in this film from the way all the characters are shot as well as written. This was a good time for me, and I really liked it. So
all right, well, this has been the Movie Morp, your premier movie autopsy podcast. You guys can find us on Twitter at Movie Morp Cast and on Facebook to search for Movie Morp Podcast. I've been your host, Jess Whitmore. You guys can find me on Twitter at Jessica on Main. That's all one word. And I'm not really doing Twitch right now. I'm gonna leave that off the copy. I don't know why I'm even saying this. Hey, where can people find you and your stuff?
People can always find me. I'm around. I'm on Twitter. You can find me under at @AnnieProducer, or, you know, come and talk on the Discord and leave a note or something. I have not been as good as I want to be at answering those, but I will get back to some of those messages and some of the links that you all have been posting. So thank you for sticking around.
yeah, that is the other thing, is we have a Discord. It's a wonderful little community. We love you all. We also have a Patreon at patreon.com/JessicaOnMain. So if you guys want to keep buying us movie tickets, that would be absolutely lovely. I like not being poor. That being said, thank you so much. If you want to support us, that's one way. The other way you can do it, that costs you absolutely nothing, is just tell a friend about us. Because please, we're big movie dorks. And if we get big enough, people are going to start yelling at us online. And it's going to be so good for clout.
It is going to be so good for clout. But, I mean, there's also the fact that we are going to get to talk to some creatives this year. So in 2020, be on the lookout for some episodes where we're talking to directors and animators. We may have some of that content coming up for you all. In the meantime, this has been the Movie Morgue. Our intro and outro music is, as always, Trouble by Ipso Factopus. We'll see y'all around. Bye.